Chapter 14. Your child's school is safer because the Secret Service studied assassins. Investigating people who threaten the life of the President of the United States, world leaders on U.S. soil, and the group of individuals the Secret Service is charged with protecting, according to 18 U.S. Code Section 3056, is unquestionably the most important mission the Secret Service has. There is no room for errors when conducting PI investigations. If a special agent interviews a PI subject who has threatened a Secret Service protectee, and that agent determines that the subject presents no threat, then, after filing a long and laborious report with Secret Service headquarters, due to the seriousness of PI investigations, headquarters monitors every PI case and holds the investigating agent to a strict reporting timeline with little tolerance for reporting delays, the case is typically closed. If the subject then attempts to harm a Secret Service protectee, not only has the agent failed to execute his or her responsibility to properly assess the threat of the subject, but the Secret Service has failed as well in managing its primary responsibility, protectee safety. The importance of learning how to properly diagnose the danger level a PI subject presents after making a presidential threat is made crystal clear to Secret Service agents from the moment they swear in as new employees. A supervisory agent I respected for his candor once told me, "You can screw up a lot of things here, but you can't screw up a PI investigation." Here is an incident I experienced that demonstrates the seriousness that Secret Service headquarters applies to PI cases. I was on duty in the New York Field Office Protective Intelligence Squad on October 3, 2002, when Steve Kim fired multiple shots from a .357 caliber revolver at the upper floors of the United Nations building on the east side of Manhattan. When the news broke and our office was notified about the incident, we sent a friend of mine, an agent named Scott, out to investigate. Secret Service headquarters was all over this, and I remember the immediate chaos in the office as headquarters repeatedly called the backup, the agent immediately in line to the supervisor of the field office squad, and wanted answers regarding the shooter's intent. During the early stages of an event such as this, intent can be tough to determine, and if it weren't for the leaflets that the shooter had with him regarding the plight of the North Koreans, then the investigation into motive and intent could have taken a while. In this case, the shooter's intent was relatively clear, but the immediate search for answers, as evidenced by the constant calls from headquarters, is an example of the gravity of a PI case and the pressure to produce immediate answers. Secret Service headquarters was concerned that the shooter was targeting a Secret Service protectee, and if that were the case, they would have demanded access to Kim early on in the arrest and interview process to assess the threat level. Immediate questions such as, "Did you act alone? Where did you acquire the weapon? Have you communicated with a Secret Service protectee before? And did you have any additional plans?" would have been critical questions if Kim were determined to be a threat to a Secret Service protectee. The Secret Service has long been recognized for its expertise in assessing the threat level of the many subjects that it comes into contact with each year for threatening their protectees. Threats are reported to the Secret Service in many ways, and I witnessed the evolution of the reporting process during my time as a special agent. When I first joined the Secret Service as an agent in 1999, most of the tips for PI cases came in via telephone to the field offices. It was pretty common for a bartender to call into the office and notify us that a drunken bar patron has said that he wanted to hurt the president, or worse. But tips came in outside of bars as well, from all sorts of places. I was working out in a gym in Melville, New York, in the early morning hours before my workday began in our Secret Service office in Long Island, when we received a tip about one of the strangest PI leads I'd ever seen. A man calling himself the Nazarene called into the Howard Stern radio show during the 6 a.m. hour and expressed a desire to kill Senator Joseph Lieberman, saying, "That Lieberman guy has gonna go. He is gonna take my bullet. He's gonna take it." Stern tried to warn the caller about the consequences of threatening a public figure, such as Lieberman, who was the Democratic vice presidential nominee at the time, and therefore a Secret Service protectee, but the Nazarene persisted, saying, "I'm telling you right now, you got the killer on the air, and that is me, right here." It wasn't long before listeners to the wildly popular radio show began lighting up the Secret Service offices with calls warning about the subject. The case quickly progressed with the cooperation of the Stern Show staff when a trace led the New York field office agents to the home of Lawrence Christian Franco. Franco worked in a facility falling in the jurisdiction of the Long Island office where I worked, and due to the publicity surrounding the events, the investigation became an immediate priority. But instead of working with us, the New York field office agents looking at the case did a bit of big leaguing to our tiny Long Island office. They properly notified the supervisor in charge of the Long Island office, but they steamrolled us a bit by telling us that they would handle the case, despite the connection to our district, and they basically sidelined us during the investigation. Franco was later arrested, and a pellet gun was found in the home where he resided. The Secret Service cannot afford mistakes in PI cases, and they are always looking for an investigative edge to employ to determine whether a subject is a threat or just a big talker. Thankfully, the overwhelming majority of threat cases are just that, big talkers. I watched the evolution of threat reporting from inside the Secret Service, where PI leads, early in my career, came in almost exclusively over the phone and by traditional mail, to my later years as an agent, when most of the tips came in over email, and now through social media. Regardless of the path these threats take in their route to a pair of Secret Service agent eyes, they all must be investigated. And in an effort to weed out, in the early stages of a PI investigation, the talkers from the doers, the Secret Service engaged in an ambitious project to determine what the investigative hallmarks of a credible threat were. The project, called the Exceptional Case Study Project, began in 1992 as an effort to generate a research study that would produce information and ideas to assist law enforcement organizations that have protective responsibilities. The project had the laudable goal of determining what specific risk factors and behavioral markers were associated with people who had assassinated, attacked, or approached with weapons prominent persons of public status in the U.S. since 1949. By painstakingly dredging through case studies of 83 assassins and potential assassins and interviewing many of these subjects, the project team came to some startling conclusions about the thinking and behavior of assassins. Many of these findings changed the way the Secret Service conducted PI investigations forever. Some of the critical takeaways from the study were these. Many of the attackers blended into society and were not extreme social outcasts, as shown in many fictional depictions of assassins. Although many didn't have an arrest history for violent crimes, there was a history of harassing others and resentments, especially towards public officials and leaders. Many of the attackers had previous contact with the mental health system, ranging from psychiatric evaluation to commitment in a mental health facility. Many considered suicide. Many took an active interest in assassination as an acceptable way to act out their grievances, and some gathered information about previous assassins. Many of them took special interest in one or more public official targets. Few of the attackers communicated a threat to the target or to a law enforcement official before their attack, but many of them communicated their interest in an attack to someone they knew. Many of the attackers practiced the attack and traveled long distances in pursuit of their target while in the planning stages of the attack. Target shifting is common, and many of the attackers will consider more than one target, only settling on a target as an opportunity presents itself. These were profound findings that, once the study was concluded in 1997, permanently changed how special agents interviewed, investigated, and evaluated subjects who threatened Secret Service protectees. Whether it's a Hollywood movie or a popular work of fiction, where an assassin is the central antagonist, Most assassins are shown as isolated social misfits, repeatedly taunting law enforcement and stalking the target they are singularly obsessed with. We've seen this character template used with the John Malkovich character in the movie In the Line of Fire, and the Robert De Niro character in the movie Taxi Driver. Both of these characters, but specifically the Malkovich character, engage in a prolonged game of cat and mouse with law enforcement, which may make for good cinema, but does not reflect the realities of a PI investigation. The findings of the study were taught to us in the Secret Service Academy during agent training, and I learned to use them later in my career in a number of protective intelligence investigations I conducted. The project's findings were crucial in one particular PI investigation I was involved with while assigned to the Secret Service's Long Island office. The target came to our attention via a telephone tip from an associate of the suspect's. This associate described a number of disturbing statements the suspect had made about wishing to harm the president. When we confronted the subject in the supermarket where he worked, he immediately became hostile and lunged for a knife from the deli counter. Thankfully, my partner and I talked the subject into dropping the knife and speaking with us. We eventually made it back to the subject's apartment, and after a long conversation about everything from his musical tastes to his relationship with his family, we got him to open up to us. Keeping the subjects talking is necessary in a PI investigation, because although there may be criminal charges later, the immediate Secret Service need is not to jail the subject, but to determine if the subject is going to harm one of their protectees. Eventually, the subject disclosed that he had a fascination with a famous female musician at that time, and this set off a bunch of bells and whistles in my head. The findings of the exceptional case study and my subsequent protective intelligence training had taught me that target shifting was a sign of potential danger, and this was a clear case of target promiscuity. That answer, combined with his history of communicating threats to friends and associates, along with other factors, caused us great concern, and I subsequently communicated my concerns to Secret Service headquarters. I was always impressed with the seriousness of the Secret Service's commitment to their agents' judgment in PI cases. Once I made the determination that the subject was a potential threat to our protectees, I was never second-guessed. The determination was not without cost, because a finding of potential danger means more than just a lot of reporting and paperwork. It can also mean years of follow-up investigations and case monitoring, which can add up to thousands of man-hours. But back then, the Secret Service had faith in its agents and its methodology. They had trained me to look for specific signs, to combine those signs with an intense background investigation into the subject and the circumstances surrounding the threat, and to make a judgment call. I still feel, over a decade later, that I made the right call in that case, and more important, I'm convinced that the Secret Service made the right call by choosing a deeply analytical approach to threat assessment, rather than being simply guided by an agent's gut feelings. In short, protective intelligence investigations and the corresponding threat assessment process the Secret Service teaches its agents is something the Secret Service does better than anyone. Given the Secret Service's extensive expertise in the evaluation of threats through the study of targeted violence, violent acts that are pre-planned and directed at a specific person or group of persons, the Secret Service once again waded into threat assessment to assist in helping diagnose the causes of another tragic development, the growing number of shootings and other targeted acts of violence in our nation's schools. After the horrific Columbine school shooting in 1999, the Secret Service lent its expertise to another exhaustive research study, applying some of its experiences with the Exceptional Case Study Project and its decades of experience in investigating and evaluating targeted threats and violence toward its protectees, to the study of school violence. The study was concluded in 2002. And some of the findings are remarkable because they point to a number of troubling similarities between the pre-attack behaviors of assassins and the pre-attack behaviors of perpetrators of targeted school violence. And whereas the perception of the presidential assassin as the societal loner, taunting law enforcement and stalking his target, was challenged by the Exceptional Case Study Project. The Secret Service's study of targeted school violence rebuked the commonly held belief that these acts were acute emotional outbursts. Some of the startling findings of the report, which should concern every parent of a school-aged child, included these. The perpetrators of school violence often tell at least one person about their plans, give out specifics before the event takes place, and obtain weapons they need, usually from their own home or from a relative's home. Many of the attackers did not act impulsively, but developed a plan weeks in advance. Many of the attackers were victims of bullying, sometimes severe. And shockingly, some of the attackers communicated their plans to other students who, rather than reporting the incident, actually encouraged the attacker to carry out their plans. The similarities here between assassins and perpetrators of school violence are striking. First, they aren't all socially isolated loners. The subject I determined to be a credible threat in the Long Island Protective Intelligence Investigation had communicated his desire to harm a Secret Service protectee to associates of his, and many of the school shooters in the Secret Service study also communicated their plans to friends. In my experience interviewing the associates of potential assassins, it was commonplace for the associates of a PI subject to report to law enforcement a credible threat by the subject. But, shockingly, that wasn't the case with many of the acts of targeted school violence. Some of the students who were told about the pending attacks both failed to report the plot and encouraged the attacker to carry out the act. This is a finding that should spark a conversation between every parent and his or her school-age children. There's no need to overdramatize the risk of being caught in a school shooting because, thankfully, the likelihood is extremely rare. But a common-sense conversation with our kids about learning to listen to their friends and, most important, to communicate to a responsible adult in the event that a friend talks about engaging in targeted school violence is an essential component of keeping them and others safe. Another similarity between assassins and targeted school violence perpetrators is the planning component. Few of these school attacks can be classified as impulsive acts. Rather, similar to the assassins, many of the school attackers planned out the events in advance. That planning can involve anything from pre-attack drawings of the school to attempts to solicit others to help carry out the violent plot. Importantly, these pre-attack behaviors can be detected if you know what you're looking for. Finally, the Exceptional Case Study Project found that many of the assassinations and assassination attempts were preceded by a life crisis that may have aggravated the psychological symptoms of the subjects, playing a role in the violent behavior. In a school environment, and in this new era of ubiquitous social media usage, this crisis can take the form of bullying, both online and in person. This is a simple conversation every parent can have with his or her child that doesn't require a government-wide public service campaign. We should all be informing our children about the damage that can be done when they decide to engage in seemingly endless online ridicule campaigns toward fellow students. This is not and never was harmless childhood behavior. I'm no safe spacer, and I most certainly don't believe in coddling our children or helicopter parenting. But children are now living in an age where they can become the objects of thousands of insults a day if someone targets them online and wishes to make a fool of them. No child has the emotional wherewithal to handle that kind of harassment, and shouldn't have to. The Secret Service study showed us all the damage that this type of behavior can cause, and it's something every responsible parent should take to heart. Part 3. How to Fix the Secret Service. Chapter 15. Worthy of Trust and Confidence. The Secret Service needs to learn how to win again and embrace their motto, Worthy of Trust and Confidence. For the sake of the country, the Secret Service needs to return to better times, when special agent resignations were so rare that when word spread about an agent's resignation, fellow agents would ask, "Why would he do that?" Despite the small size of the Secret Service relative to the other federal law enforcement agencies, they serve two critical missions for the maintenance of our constitutional republic. They secure the life of the President of the United States, and they secure the integrity of the nation's money supply. Unfortunately, the expanding mission of the Secret Service and the growing threat environment requires that the Secret Service forfeit portions of their current investigative mission in order to fulfill their protection mission. The Secret Service does not have the manpower or the time to be involved in credit card fraud investigations, counterfeit currency investigations, electronic crimes investigations, 419 fraud, email and paper mail scams, where innocent victims are solicited by phony Nigerian princes looking to give them millions of dollars in exchange for their bank account numbers, major events security, and protective intelligence investigations. The Secret Service does presidential protection better than any government agency in the world, and that's where they add substantial value for U.S. taxpayers, not in doing financial crimes investigations, which can easily be absorbed by the FBI. Although the transition would be painful at first for many of the current crop of special agents, many of whom have grown to enjoy criminal investigative work and have never known a time when they weren't expected to conduct criminal investigations, it would benefit both the agents and Secret Service management to focus on high value-added activities. This includes presidential protection, major event security, critical infrastructure protection, electronic crimes, and protective intelligence operations. Giving up their counterfeit, credit card fraud, and 419 fraud investigative work would allow the Secret Service to refocus its mission and leverage the skills it has acquired from decades of presidential protection work across complementary activities, such as critical infrastructure protection and major events security. When a Secret Service agent does security advance work for one of their protectees, one of the tasks they regularly perform is a thorough security evaluation of the location the protectee is going to visit. Agents look at the building's air intake system, the fire suppression system, the location of crash bar doors close automatically and prevent stairways from filling with smoke in a fire, to ensure that escape routes are accessible in the event of a fire, the network connectivity of the building to make sure that critical information technology systems cannot be hacked, the location of the firebox, the location of the security cameras, and more. After decades of conducting security advances such as this, in buildings and facilities all across the country, the Secret Service would be the ideal agency to lead a national collaborative effort between private industry and government to secure our nation's critical infrastructure. This effort wouldn't require any additional taxpayer money, and it would be completely voluntary for private industry. But it would help the Secret Service in a few ways. If the Secret Service were to give up its financial crimes and counterfeit investigations, it would free up large blocks of time for Secret Service agents. Some presidents travel frequently, such as President Clinton, and some travel only when necessary, such as President Reagan. The Secret Service has to be prepared for the worst-case travel scenario, however, and doesn't have the luxury of dismissing its workforce and then rehiring them when the campaign and presidential travel seasons heat up. The Secret Service is no different from a big-city fire department in this regard. Fire departments do not start fires to prove their worth. They wait for a fire event, and they are vigilantly prepared to respond to that event. The same principles should apply to the Secret Service with a presidential visit. Allowing the Secret Service, in the downtime between protection operations, to work with private industry to help provide security consultation for the nation's power plants, critical electrical infrastructure, critical internet hubs, and other infrastructure assets necessary for our national safety and survival would allow agents the opportunity to fine-tune their site security skills while developing networks of industry contacts within their respective field office districts. This would benefit the agency as a whole when a Secret Service protectee visits their districts. This would also fill a major hole in our nation's security. As our society has evolved from a dependency on agriculture and manufacturing to a more diversified economy dependent on service sectors and connectivity, the line between private and public has blurred with regard to critical infrastructure national security. For example, no one doubts the need to secure our nation's military facilities and government buildings, such as the White House and our courts. But with our growing dependency on energy and internet connectivity networks, isn't it critical that we also focus on securing our nation's electrical grid and internet connectivity, despite the fact that they are not government assets in the traditional sense? Now, to be clear, I am a strong advocate for limited government, and I am not suggesting anything more than making the Secret Service available to consult with the private industry representatives responsible for our energy grid, critical internet infrastructure, national ports, and our other vital national security interests to assist in providing security guidance and best practices. The Secret Service is perfectly suited for this role because they are already involved in similar ventures through their leadership role in the coordination of the nation's electronic crimes task forces in the investigation and prosecution of internet crimes, and their role with the Department of Homeland Security as a partner in the U.S. CERT, United States Computer Emergency Readiness Team. The U.S. CERT is a collaborative venture between federal law enforcement and the technology industry to analyze threats and exchange critical cybersecurity information with trusted partners around the world. The U.S. CERT is a model for handling the increasingly blurry line between critical government assets and critical private industry assets in this new era of essential worldwide connectivity. The Secret Service uses this network of willing private and government partners to spread information about the latest cyber vulnerabilities and trends in internet-based crimes, all at little expense to the taxpayer. Expanding this model into business spheres outside of the technology industry, such as the energy sector, is a logical next step. The Secret Service wouldn't be required to do anything more than to provide unclassified security consultation to willing private industry partners, and private industry would then be responsible for investing in the necessary security upgrades using their own capital. Undoubtedly, this effort to move the Secret Service away from financial crimes and into collaborative critical infrastructure security wouldn't come without friction. A knowledgeable defense expert associate of mine, who served in the Reagan administration, once described the problem for me. He explained that our nation has a glaring hole in our electrical transmission infrastructure because of the threat of an electromagnetic pulse, EMP, attack, generated from an atmospheric nuclear weapon detonation. This scenario may seem far-fetched, but it is very real in the eyes of our geopolitical adversaries, who understand that an attack such as this would wipe out electrical power for millions of Americans instantaneously. In addition, our national capacity to rebuild the electrical transformers that would be damaged in an EMP attack would be severely compromised, and as a result, it could take years to get the nation's electrical power back. Literally millions of Americans could die if an attack like this were successfully implemented. With a catastrophic threat such as this, a reasonable person would conclude that our nation had already developed a thorough plan, in conjunction with the energy sector, to harden up our electrical grid to ensure that it could still function after being exposed to an EMP attack. But despite some efforts to solve the problem, notably, a recent push by the U.S. government's Defense Advanced Research Project, DARPA, in conjunction with BAE Systems to develop alternative communication networks that would come into use in case of a cyber attack on the U.S. electrical grid, the nation's electrical grid is still largely unprotected from this catastrophic threat. One of the reasons behind this intransigence is an ongoing dispute about who should absorb the costs for this effort. Private industry, the government, or both. The same disputes would likely emerge from a new Secret Service-led effort to provide best practices and guidance for private industry. Once a government agency, such as the Secret Service, provides security advice and guidance, private industry may hesitate when they see the costs of security upgrades. Even worse, many might avoid consultation with the Secret Service at all, figuring that ignorance is bliss. If they are told about holes in their security plans and they fail to act, many industry figures may be rightly concerned about lawsuits in the event of a security incident. These are real concerns, but they can be remedied with strict operating and disclosure rules for private organizations joining the consortium. Reforming the mission of the Secret Service should also include an expansion of their protective intelligence role. Although forfeiting the financial crimes and counterfeiting missions is essential to freeing up limited Secret Service manpower assets, they must hold on to the investigative responsibilities for threats to their protectees. Protective intelligence investigations are complicated investigations that require a Secret Service agent to dig deep into the mind of a potential assassin to determine the subject's intent. There is no room for mistakes in these PI investigations, and learning to competently conduct them can provide an agent with essential insight into the psychological states of the people wishing to do their protectees harm. After interviewing multiple suspects accused of threatening the president and other Secret Service protectees, I became all too familiar with the look, that blank stare a sociopath with no attachment to any moral code gives you when you are interviewing him about a threat he made to the president. You learn quickly when dealing with sociopaths, a category into which many potential assassins fall, not to try to get a sincere apology or a morally relevant explanation of why they did what they did. Most of them did it because they wanted to, because it filled some physical or mental unmet need, regardless of the pain they were looking to cause. They are not overwhelmed by a sense of shame and sorrow for their actions, because the moral code most of us live by does not equally govern their actions. These are critical skills that translate directly to the effectiveness of the protection mission. I recall multiple instances of agents on post within a secure perimeter telling supervisors that something just wasn't right about a person, and later being proven right when the person was interviewed. Although not all of these people were assassins or terrorists, many of them were there exclusively to cause trouble for the Secret Service. There's no good substitute for experience in protective intelligence investigations. It's possible that what set off many of these agents' trouble antenna was their ability to observe barely quantifiable behavioral indicators that they had experience in dealing with from their investigations of threat cases. Keeping protective intelligence investigations under the Secret Service umbrella, while turning over financial crimes and counterfeit investigations to other federal agencies, will also ensure that the Secret Service allocates more of its limited manpower to the exploding number of social media threats driven by President Trump's unprecedented use of social media platforms. President Trump personally communicates regularly using Twitter, unlike past presidents, who used the platform through official channels. And this has invited a growing number of threatening responses. Twitter threats are nothing new to the Secret Service, but the public knows the president personally uses Twitter, and many PI subjects have decided to take the opportunity to personally threaten him by responding. Regardless of what the Secret Service says publicly, this has put an incredible strain on the agency, because they cannot afford to ignore threats simply because they originate from a Twitter user. I fear that this threat stream emanating from social media will only grow in the future as President Trump redefines the role of social media within the presidency. And the future growth in social media threats will require a manpower response from the Secret Service. With government-wide budget cuts likely coming in the future due to our nearly $20 trillion national debt, big increases in Secret Service hiring are unlikely. Therefore, it's critical that the Secret Service upper management get ahead of this problem today by looking at reallocating financial crimes manpower assets to protective intelligence. Another lingering problem for the Secret Service that requires an immediate fix is their over-reliance on internal promotions for their upper management team. The use of strictly internal promotions to fill the headquarters management staff of the Secret Service has promoted a groupthink atmosphere with no set of outside eyes to critically analyze major decisions. I place the blame for the destruction of Secret Service morale largely on a series of disastrous decisions made by the headquarters management teams over the past two decades. First, the decision to expand the Secret Service portfolio of responsibilities by taking on security responsibilities for significant national security events designated NSSEs was an avoidable mistake. Although the skill set Secret Service agents have, due to their protection responsibilities, is a strong fit for a coordination role in securing NSSE events, this role should be strictly advisory, similar to what I proposed for the private industry Secret Service Critical Infrastructure Security Consortium. Having well-trained and taxpayer-funded Secret Service agents work as security guards at events such as the Salt Lake City Olympics was a mistake that did substantial damage to special agent morale as the NSSE assignments piled up. Secret Service management erred terribly in not taking a stand on this earlier, when the complaints from the agents on the ground began to pile up. They should have resolutely refused to provide special agent manpower, essential to keeping the president and their growing number of protectees safe for security at events that had no nexus whatsoever to the Secret Service's core protection mission. Second, the decision by Secret Service management, many of whom had relocated many times themselves, to continue the destructive policy of requiring relocations for continued promotion within the agency, was one that still boggles the mind. Nearly every agent I spoke with during my time in the New York field office, the Secret Service Training Center, the PPD, and while on the road conducting protection operations, absolutely despised this policy. Yet, headquarters managers refused to change the relocation policy and only made token changes to the career track options, which had little impact on the real lives of agents who loved the Secret Service but also loved their families and refused to repeatedly relocate them. Hundreds of talented special agents were lost to other federal agencies due to this misguided policy, and no one was held accountable for this disaster. By filling some senior executive service management positions within the Secret Service with people who have never served in the agency, it would finally be possible to get a critical set of outside eyes on the operations of the agency. Eyes that have not been subjected to the infamous, because that's the way we've always done it, groupthink trap that currently pervades the agency. Military and business leaders have not always done it the Secret Service way. And although there are no guarantees, outsiders to the Secret Service would be more likely to ask critical questions such as, why the hell are we moving agents around the country, spending a fortune to do so, and getting nothing more than mass resignations and crushed morale to show for it? I assure you, a successful business or military leader would not accept an answer such as, because that's the way we've always done it. The excuse for not doing this has traditionally been, the Secret Service has a unique and hard-to-understand protection mission, and an outside manager from the agency wouldn't understand it. Yes, the protection mission is incredibly complicated, but so is building a modern motor vehicle. And yet, no one expects the CEO of a major car company to be able to walk on the assembly line and build the vehicle himself. The upper management of any organization doesn't have to grasp every nuance of the organization they run, but it's essential that they lead the organization by providing strategic vision and audacious, visionary goals. Leadership means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, but you can be assured that your organization's leadership has failed when the overwhelming majority of your workforce cites the lack of leadership as a problem in employee surveys, and the documented history of critical decision-making leaves behind a trail of mission failure, employee attrition, and bruised morale. New leadership from outside of the Secret Service isn't limited by the tunnel vision groupthink that is all too common throughout today's Secret Service. Many of the executive management staff of today's Secret Service grew up together in the agency and learned from one another. Many were successful security advance agents who taught others how to navigate the difficult world of presidential protection. The presidential protection agents who excel at the mechanics of security advance work may not be best suited as upper-level managers tasked with dealing with Congress on the mission of the Secret Service, with dealing with the Secret Service workforce on quality of life issues, or with dealing with the media when there is a Secret Service crisis. Sometimes, having nothing but insiders managing an organization encourages repetition of the same mistakes because no one realizes that a mistake has even been made. It reminds me of a story I once heard about a junior firefighter who survived a massive outdoor forest fire while his senior firefighter associates perished. One of the reasons given was that the senior firefighters were trained to never leave behind their gear, and therefore they tragically perished when the flames engulfed them as they were weighed down by the bulky gear. The junior firefighter didn't respond the same way. He ditched his gear and escaped. Sometimes, inexperience with mistakes can be an advantage, and in the case of the Secret Service, it's time to try something new as the mistakes pile up. America cannot afford to lose another president, and fixing the Secret Service is the only way to ensure that we don't. This concludes Protecting the President by Dan Bongino, narrated by L.J. Ganser. Copyright 2017 by Dan Bongino. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with WND Books, Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.